behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott Benson.
And I'm Ben Boland.
Ben, we've got a strange tale today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a weird, weird piece of automotive history.
We're even going to need some strange tale music in the beginning here.
That's probably true. And we're going to talk about a vehicle that is called the Dale. Now, if you don't know about the Dale, hang on, because there's a big twist that's coming somewhere near the middle of this story that you probably didn't expect. Maybe, maybe not. If you know about it, you know what's coming. But either way, this is about an American-made car that I guess you could say it's an American-made car that never really was.
Right.
It's a tale of deception in more ways than one, really.
Yeah.
There's a lot of deception going on in this whole thing. And again, we already mentioned the twist that's coming up, so there's a lot to this story, and it's just a fascinating bit of automotive history to me.
Yeah. So cast your minds back to the glamorous, wild world of 1974.
Yeah, we go way back. That's almost 40 years. Well, it is 40 years ago at this point, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So it's a long, long time ago, and this is the formation of a company called the 20th Century Motor Car Corporation. And they had one vehicle that they were promoting at the time, and it was called the Dale. And this Dale vehicle was a revolutionary vehicle at the time, or said to be a revolutionary vehicle at the time. Mm-hmm. You got to remember the time frame for this whole thing. Now, it was
out of the fuel embargo.
The early 1970s, exactly right. The fuel embargo was going on. Now, it promised a lot of things, and there were a lot of different car designs that were coming out at this time. Now, a lot of ideas for fuel efficiency, for saving fuel. So there were bodies made of carbon fiber even back then. There were bodies that were fitted with wings, some that floated on water. There were three-wheelers. There were six-wheelers.
Yep.
They went back to steam engines for a while. Jet turbines were something that they were kind of playing around with, if you remember that. We talked about the Ford vehicle that was going to go with nuclear power. And there was at least one developer that decided that the three-wheel option was the way to go.
Ah, yes. That was a gentleman named Dale Clift.
Dale Clift. Now, this is the guy that the Dale car is eventually named after.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he plays a role in this, but not as much of a role as you may think. Early on, we'll talk about him quite a bit here, but he had this idea. He said, I wanted to make this three-wheel vehicle. He's a Southern California inventor.
Yeah, and he's working for some pretty large-scale electronic military contract.
Exactly, but he likes to also kind of mess around with things in his side times, I guess, you know, his time off. And he was kind of mechanically messing around with a lot of different personal projects. I think he built a bicycle motor, and he built a device that was designed to blow insulation into an existing wall. He also played around with motorcycle engines and things like that, you know, kind of mechanical things and commuting vehicles. That was one of his ideas, was how to create a three-wheel commuting vehicle that was powered by a motorcycle engine.
Right.
And
yep.
He developed a vehicle with, he built this, you know, I don't know if we want to say that he built it with a friend, maybe, from the company that he's working with.
Ooh.
And I don't want to really give too much away here at this point, but he built it in his garage in suburban Los Angeles. And it was the three-wheel design. It was, if I can just describe it this way, this is the way it was written in the place where we're getting this book or this information from, this story from.
Oh, yeah, and this would be familiar to our listeners.
Yeah, that's right. The book is called History's Greatest Automotive Mysteries, Myths, and Rumors Revealed. And we've used this several times in this mm-hmm. podcast to, you know, glean some stories from some of the stranger parts of our past, I guess, in automotive past.
Yeah, this is kind of like a collection of Ripley's Believe It or Not tales specifically about cars.
Yeah, it's like, think of like a Snopes story only expanded. You know, there's a lot more information here, so we're going to kind of read through this. And there's parts of this article that we'll read. And one part that I want to read here is about this vehicle. Now, the vehicle itself, they say that the frame consisted of half-inch electrical conduit with the joints that were brazed together. So the mechanical components came from the motorcycle world.
Mm-hmm.
The engine, for example, was a robust 305cc twin from a Honda CB77 Superhawk. And while there were two front wheels, they were suspended with motorcycle style forks. So the whole thing was covered with Naugahyde in a metal flake maroon.
Which is crazy.
Now, Naugahyde, you know, that's like plastic leather, really. That's fake leather.
Yeah.
And so that's the exterior of this. And we talked about that an obscure car that was covered with something like this, but it had foam, I think, on the outside.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
A similar type covering. Oh, that was the safari car. That was it, right?
Yeah, in our obscure car episode.
Yeah, exactly. Now, he completes this three-wheel prototype vehicle, which they said actually looked pretty good from the outside. He completed it in 1973, so he's working on this early on. And he used it to drive around town. He used to get around town in this thing. He would go back and forth to work, and you know, he had it licensed for street use.
Right. He had it registered as a motorcycle. Now, of course, it wasn't perfect. It had a lot of the disadvantages that you see in cottage industry garage-built vehicles, mm-hmm. so carbon monoxide could leak into it. And it was a two-seater, too.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty good. So two-seater. So he would sometimes take a friend with him to work or, you know, just to run errands around town. And
sure.
People, it garnered a lot of attention. In fact, it got attention of local press eventually. And I'll tell you about that in just one second. But I also want to say that, you know, along with, you know, everything that it was doing right, it also had a lot of flaws. Now,
right.
Some of these flaws, I guess, and these are typical of somebody, you know, something that someone would build in their garage.
Right. Like you said.
Yeah. I mean, it would leak carbon monoxide into the cockpit, which is a bad problem to have. I'll tell you that if you're going a long trip. You know, the stopping power from the brakes was really, really negligible because tiny tires, cable driven brakes.
Right.
You can imagine what that was like.
And this might surprise some people who, I don't know if you're a fan of Naugahyde or something, but it turns out that if this thing ever got in a crash, Dale was screwed.
Yeah. If you're driving a Naugahyde car, I don't think you're going to want to hit too many other vehicles or walls or anything like that, or really anything at
but
all.
But again, this is the kind of car that we have talked about before, the kind of vehicle rather. Mm-hmm. It's a small, light vehicle with a kind of short range, at least the way he was building it, that is meant for not highway driving. It's meant for commuting inside a city.
And that's exactly what he was doing when finally, you know, some of the local press, I guess, kind of got wind of what was going on. And they saw him around town and they said, hey, let's make a great story. Let's talk to him.
Yeah.
So they actually interviewed him and they talked to him about, you know, what he was doing and got a story and everything. That was all kind of interesting. But then that gets more attention because more people see this. And through that attention is where possibly this may be the turning point in the story. This is the twist that I was going to tell you about, but this is where a meeting happened that I think was a setup right from the very beginning. And a lot of people, I think looking back that this was a setup. It was a planned meeting. But in 1974, while he was eating dinner in a restaurant on Ventura Boulevard, he was approached by a stranger who told him that stranger said that I know somebody who might be willing to put this three-wheel vehicle that you have into production.
Right, which at the time, some people were saying he called it the commuter cycle.
Yeah. Yep.
So a lot of this story, it's time to introduce this other guy too. A lot of this story comes from a close friend of Dale's named Richard Smith.
Mm-hmm.
And so Richard Smith wrote a book about this called The Dale Automobile, An American Dream. And a lot of our accounts are coming via Smith. So Smith is one of the people who believes that this quote unquote chance meeting was planned from the beginning.
Yeah, and there's good reason for that later on, as we'll find out. I mean, looking back, you know, they try to piece this all together, really.
So who is this stranger?
Well, the stranger that is supposedly able to put this thing into production is a woman by the name of Geraldine Elizabeth Carmichael. Now, I think her friends called her Liz or Liz Carmichael, and we'll just call her Liz Carmichael. How about that?
That sounds good.
But her full name is Geraldine Elizabeth Carmichael, and the way she's described here in this article is that she was a huge woman. Anywhere from 6 feet tall and 175 pounds to somewhere around 6 feet 2 inches tall and 225 pounds, depending on who you talk to.
Right. And depending on who you talk to, again, she was either an Indiana farm girl who worked on tractors, a former stock car racer, entrepreneur from the University of Miami, a mechanical engineer from Ohio State, the widow of a NASA structural engineer.
Mm-hmm.
Or the owner of a car mod company, former owner, customizer.
Yep, patent holder. She said
she had
patents. There's this long list. She had this self-skinning foam, apparently, that, you know, she was a patent holder on. And, you know, again, what stands out to you, Ben, about this right away? I mean, this sounds like a charlatan, doesn't it? It sounds like somebody who's just breezing into town. It's like one of the people selling snake oil, doesn't it?
Well, you know, it does. I'm just going to, in the interest of being fair, Scott, I'm playing devil's advocate. I'll go ahead and say that I guess it's possible for one person to have done all these things.
I guess so. But my gosh, Ben, this is quite a resume, really.
Yeah,
when you think
about
it.
This is a life well lived.
Exactly. Now she's saying, you know, Liz is saying, I can get this car into production for you. And, you know, and she wasn't telling everybody all those things all at once.
She was telling this to different people who asked her different times.
Yeah. So she's living this life where she's telling multiple lies all over the place, right?
No way that can come back to get you.
Exactly. Right.
But think about what amazing news this is for Dale Cliff.
Yeah.
Because if you are an inventor, and I know we have some inventors who listen to the show, Scott. So one thing that happens to a lot of inventors is that you come up with an astonishing, revolutionary idea, but you have neither the capital nor the know-how needed to bring this thing to store shelves.
And at the same time, you want to protect your idea. You want you want to hold on to that. So, you know, you're being cautious, but you also have to be a bit adventurous in that, you know, you have to say, yeah, I've got to throw caution to the wind here with this one because I believe this person and what they say. And you can only go on their credentials and what they tell you, I suppose. A lot more difficult at that time probably to look into someone's background than it was, you know, than it is now.
Right. So our girl Liz comes to Dale and says, you know, I want to put this brilliant design into production and I can give you, well, it might be $3 million.
$3 million. Now she's saying, you know, that your royalties for this whole thing would be $3 million if you give me this design and let me run with it.
Right.
And of course he would remain, you know, in partial control of the whole thing and, you know, part of the company as well. However, you know, she would be the controlling partner of this whole thing. And, of course, she's going to stand to make a lot more money because she's going to risk everything, apparently, right? That's going to be her role.
Right. Yeah. So he's essentially being offered a deal to sell the rights to the car.
Exactly right. Now, and, you know, of course, also the promise that your name will be on the vehicle. It's going to be called the Dale. That's going to be the name of the car.
Ooh,
so
that's a tough one to walk away.
That is a tempting offer for any inventor, you know, to say like, well, of course, you're going to name the vehicle after me. How cool would that be, by the way?
So let's fast forward to August.
All right. So August of 1974, and the company is finally formed. It's called the, and Liz Carmichael sets this up. She calls it the 20th Century Motor Car Company, which may be a little bit familiar to readers of Ayn Rand, right?
Yeah, right, from Ayn Rand's famous novel, Atlas Shrugged.
That's right, and it was the title was just a little bit different. It was the 20th Century Motor Company in the book. Now, if you, again, this one is the 20th Century Motor Car Corporation, so very, very similar.
Right.
I could see where a lot of people would be confused with this. Now, again, this is set up in August of 1974 by Liz Carmichael, and it was supposed to be the company that would carry the flagship Dale vehicle, you know, this prototype three-wheel, two-seater sports car that was designed by Dale Cliff. You know, it was supposed to be the greatest thing since sliced bread. It was a very futuristic vehicle. They had everything laid out, you know, how it was going to be powered, what the shell was going to be made of,
what the specs,
the glass was going to be made of. Exactly. Yeah. It was supposed to be powered by an 850cc air-cooled engine, and it claimed that it would have, it would get 70 miles per gallon.
Right. But still go 85.
Still go 85 miles per hour. That's right. And so, you know, with this great fuel economy, the expected price for this, Ben.
Here we go.
$2,000 in 1974. That's US dollars. $2,000, which, you know, I guess when you're looking at, you know, 1974 dollars, and at the time, you know, for what a car cost and with the fuel prices and all that, this was a very attractive package, right?
Do you have the numbers for the modern day?
I'm glad you asked, Ben, because I do. I've done my little, you know, inflation calculator thing that I like to do with these often. And, I've got something that I've more of a question really than anything.
Okay.
Now I did the calculation. Now $2,000 in 1974 is equal in 2014 to $9,524.58. So still a cheap vehicle.
Yeah. New and under $10,000.
To buy a brand new vehicle like that. This reminds me of the Elio in some way, but I hate to say it along with the story, but it does. Now, here's something that I want to point out. I went to a site called The Cost of Living, thecostofliving.com.
Yeah.
And I looked up what the average price of a car was in 1974. And the average price in 1974 was $3,750. So this vehicle is coming in way under the average price.
Yeah.
Almost half of it. But then I was thinking, okay, that equivalent today, if you just go by inflation. So I did that number, the 3750, into 2014 dollars, and yeah. try to follow me here.
I'm following.
I did the equivalent, and the equivalent is $17,858.60.
Versus under 10,000?
Yeah.
For the modern day price of the Dale.
Exactly. That's right. Now, but the point that I want to get at with this is, now, if you just go by straight inflation, now the average cost of the car in 1974 was $37.50. If you take that number to today, it's $17,858. Do you remember just not long ago when we talked about the average price of a new car? You remember what that number was?
Oh, yeah. It's in the 30s.
$31,252. Mm-hmm. So what happened?
Something happened.
What happened that if we had just gone by, you know, from straight inflation, it should be, I mean, if this were to play out equally,
right, right.
I guess, $17,858 versus $31,252. I think that, you know, it has to do with a lot of the added federal safety regulation.
I was exactly going to say that.
Yeah. And the, I guess the exotic materials that they build cars out of, you know, sometimes these days.
And the rate of inflation is not itself constant.
Anyways, that just gives you a little something to think about. And I thought it was interesting along the way that, you know, I guess apples to apples, the price of a new sedan should be $17,008 instead of $31,200.
Yeah. But if you really want to see those numbers in a way that, or that rate of growth in a way that can hit home for a lot of our listeners, mm-hmm. especially some of our younger listeners, check the cost of college back in 1974.
Oh my gosh. These
adjust
things,
that for inflation.
These will drive you insane. If you go back and you look at some of the numbers. So if you want to go to thecostofliving.com and you can find some information there. And if you pair that up with an inflation calculator, that's where you'll start to get mad.
Make yourself a stiff drink, honestly, if you drink before you read some of this stuff.
Do something. Try to relax.
But here we are back in 1974 in August. And Scott, this feels cinematic, some of the stuff that's going on,
right? Yeah, some big claims.
Right. So, Liz Carmichael immediately gets together a sales team. They start producing vehicles in on Deering Avenue in Canoga Park. They've got an office in Encino, and she famously says, "Look, we're all going to be fabulously wealthy, or we'll go to jail."
Ah, very prophetic, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, as we'll find out. And I'm sure that you know where this is going now, but there's still another twist.
But before we go on, Scott, I'd like to pause for a moment with that cliffhanger prophetic statement.
So we were talking here about the Dale, right?
Yes.
And we were just getting to some of these big claims, I guess, that Liz Carmichael was making about this vehicle, right?
Yeah, excellent mileage.
Yeah.
Great performance speed.
Exactly. And she has a 6-page full color brochure printed up, which showcases all of the things that, you know, the Dale is supposedly going to do, the 70-mile-per-gallon Dale.
Dollar for dollar, the best car ever built.
Yep, the most exciting new car of the century, the first space-age automobile.
Designed and built like it's ready to be driven to the moon.
Yeah, the most exciting idea that ever happened to personal transportation. The eyes of the world are on the amazing new Dale. It's a masterpiece in automotive design and engineering, a whole new standard of performance, economy, and safety. Available in no other car in the world today. So these bold, bold statements, you know, that come from this brochure. And these brochures, by the way, are still out there. You can find one if you know a collector, I would guess. Difficult to find, but anyways.
So they also claim the car's structure itself is everything but bulletproof.
Yeah.
So they said that the shell of the Dale was made of a, quote, rocket structural resin, whatever that means.
Ah, well, that goes back to her, you know, she's the widow of a NASA structural engineer.
Ben. Oh, that's right. I'm sure it was her her former husband's secret invention. It will absorb over 4 times the impact of a Cadillac without serious damage. And the windows were made of something called Rigidex.
Yeah, which is, I've never heard of Rigidex, but it's 70 times the impact resistance of safety glass. So only the force of a bullet, Ben, could penetrate that.
Yeah.
That's according to her.
And so, additionally, it had a printed circuit dashboard, so...
I'm laughing about this one.
Yeah, okay. Just walk me through this and make sure I got this correct.
Okay, yep.
Okay, so, so it had a printed circuit dashboard with plug-in accessories,
which is claimed to make it easier to operate, easier to work on. You know, things won't go wrong. It's like a solid state thing, right?
I mean, yeah. So like your radio, your heater, your AC goes out, you can just pull it out.
Pull it out, plug a new one in.
Right.
Or repair it and then put it back in.
Which
and,
is what Tesla is doing with batteries today.
Yeah, but the idea behind this was that the vehicle had no wires. And there's a flaw in this idea because, you know, all the headlights, you know, any other accessory beyond what's right in the dash can't be plugged into a circuit board like that.
It sounds like at best there's a legalistic definition of wiring.
Did it have an electric starter? Because if it did, it has wires.
Right.
I mean, there's just no way, unless the entire vehicle was a printed circuit board, there's no way that it was a wireless vehicle.
Maybe it had the wires replaced by Rigidex.
Yeah. And then the, maybe, Ben. And then the everything. I mean, it claimed it had air conditioning. It had, you know, a heater and everything. It had all the features, right? The engine that they claimed it had and the warranty is pretty interesting as well because they claimed it was powered by a 40 horsepower, 850 cc horizontally opposed twin engine, from a BMW motorcycle. And of course we mentioned the 85 mile per hour top speed already, but it came with, you know, quite a decent warranty really for the time.
Yeah. 15 months, 15,000 miles.
Exactly. And if you wanted to pay an additional $100, Ben, of course, if you wanted to up your game a little bit, you could, for another $100, you could double that warranty to 30 months and 30,000 miles just for $100. Who wouldn't do that, right?
Only a fool.
Only a fool. That's right. And they actually went so far as to put a mock-up on display at the 20th Century office in Encino. I think it was Encino, right?
Yeah.
And they put stanchions all around the vehicle so you couldn't get really too close to it to take a good close-up look at the vehicle.
Right. And there's a reason for that.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't quite what the production model was supposed to be.
Well, they didn't say that right up front, though. They said this is a mock-up. So this is, you know, what the car will be. This is representative of the vehicle.
Right.
Now, one of the things that stood out to anybody who looked at this vehicle, Ben, it featured front wheels nailed to a 4x4 that served as the front axle.
Yeah, but that wasn't the only car display they had. They also did have a prototype.
Ben, did you hear me?
I said
the wheels were nailed to a 4x4 that was supposed to be the front axle of their mock-up vehicle.
Yeah, but they said mock-up.
Okay. All right. So, good point taken. Let's move on to the prototype like you want to. I want to dwell on this just a little bit more,
okay,
but that's fine.
Okay, we can dwell some more.
Well, okay. How about this?
What?
They ran that prototype that you're talking about. They ran it, and it ran so poorly that they had to go back to the original Dale Clift mock-up, you know, the one that was covered in Naugahyde.
Yeah, his commuter car.
They showed him a vehicle that wasn't even the Dale for the promotional video of this thing because they couldn't get the Dale prototype to actually work all that well. It ran, but it ran very, very poorly.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is just another thing where, you know, and in this promotional video or in this promotional material, I guess, they're claiming that they have $33 million invested in this thing already.
Yeah.
Does that sound like a couple of vehicles that have $33 million invested already?
Not in
1975?
Yeah, not really, because that's a lot of money, especially in that time.
Well, in 1975, $33 million was a lot of scratch. I mean, now you can barely retire on that, but, you know, that's the way it was back then. I should have done the conversion for that.
Oh, no, wait, I don't know if I could take it emotionally.
So all this is going on, right? There's the mock-up, there's the prototype, neither of which really run. The mock-up, no way. The prototype runs roughly. They went back to the Dale Clift design for the promotional video. And then she claims that she has 100 employees working in a 150,000 square foot facility in Burbank, California. And the projections called for astronomical number of cars being built each year, right?
Right.
88,000 cars were supposed to be sold during the first year of production, and then after that, 250,000 vehicles were supposed to be built for the second year at 100 dealerships and 210 distributors all over the country, at least, if not all over the world. I'm not sure if it went worldwide or not.
Onward and upward, buddy.
But she's selling dealerships, and she's also selling distributorships to people ahead of time, which, I don't know. Other people have done that.
Preston Tucker did that.
Preston Tucker has done that, and that comes up later, as we'll find out. But she's selling a lot of stuff that is right now, as we call it, vaporware.
Yes. And let's go ahead and add something here, because there's a little bit of trouble in paradise between Dale and Liz. This is a sidebar that comes from an interview with the author, Richard Smith, that we mentioned earlier. So this interview is courtesy of the folks at threewheelers.com. And they had a question here where they said, did Dale have any concerns about some of the claims about how this vehicle would perform or be made?
Mm-hmm.
And Richard says, I would talk to Dale about some of the concerns he had with what Liz was telling him. And anyone who would listen, Dale at this time was so supportive of the project, it was difficult to approach him with the reality that some of the claims for the Dale might not stand. Dale finally put his foot down when Liz claimed 70 miles to the gallon. From this time forward, with this claim and others, Dale began to put two and two together.
Ah, so now he's starting to wisen up. But right at first, he's completely on board.
He's on board.
At this point in the story, Ben, at this point, because now we'll find out that, you know, later there's a little bit of a rift between the two of them.
Yeah.
But right now, at this point, he's still on board. Now, you said that, okay, you did mention the 70 mile per hour or 70 miles per gallon thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay, so maybe he's already having some doubts, but he's still backing the company and saying that, yeah, we're going to go forward with this idea.
It's amazing to see a dream made reality, man.
Yeah. Well, the problem was that they're starting to be investigated as well. Now, there's a cease and desist order that's filed by the California Corporation Commission, which I guess was supposed to prohibit the company from continuing to sell stock in the corporation at that point. And this is in September of 1974, I believe.
Oh, can I do the quote?
Sure.
This is from Liz Carmichael, who remained unrepentant.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to sound like an egomaniac, but I am a genius, she told the Associated Press. I believe 100% that this car will revolutionize the industry.
All right. You know, and just after she made that statement, okay, so she's making this bold statement, you know, after the cease and desist order is being levied upon the 20th century business, you know, overall, the Dale, you know, falling under that umbrella. We find out that, Car and Driver sends out a reporter, and this pretty much uncovers this whole thing as a scam. And
so,
here's the way it goes down. And I want to read this paragraph because this is pretty interesting. Now, this is toward the end of, I believe it's toward the end of 1974 when this happens, or is it 1975? Maybe early 1975. It says, Car and Driver dispatched photographer Mike Salisbury to see Carmichael at her plant in person. So he's headed out to the plant to take a photograph and get the story for Car and Driver magazine, right? A yellow egg-like car, which was the Dale, was parked in a corner. And so this is, you know, either the mock-up or the prototype. I'm not sure which. It says when he went to the vehicle, there was no gas pedal or steering wheel in the vehicle. So it sounds to me like it's maybe the mock-up. Ringed around the car when he arrived were a couple of guys wearing Clark Kent glasses and scribbling on clipboards. Salisbury was convinced that they were performing a pantomime for his benefit. So this is a ruse right from the onset, you know?
Yeah.
They got people that are supposedly, I don't know, Ben, scientists that are doing, you know, making scientific evaluations of the vehicle. And
They're wearing glasses.
They're wearing glasses and lab coats, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But they're definitely intended to give this Car and Driver reporter the idea that, yeah, there are people working on this car all the time, and they're very important.
On the off chance he's a moron.
Yeah, so very, very studious.
What's the rest of this?
Well, as soon as they walked away from the vehicle, you know, because they were done with their clipboards apparently at that point, as soon as they walked away, he opened the engine compartment and found that there was a Briggs & Stratton lawnmower engine inside, and it didn't take much to realize that the whole thing was a scam, he said. You know, but the best was yet to come.
And I think, if you're okay with it, Scott, on that note, let's pause this for part one of our podcast on the Dale car.
I mean, as he says, the best is yet to come. Can we break it right here?
Yeah.
I don't think listeners are getting tired of it. I hope not.
No, I hope not, because this is not even the crazy part.
No, there's a crazy twist coming, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, and just to give us a taste of a little something different, I've got some listener mail before we close out.
Let's do it.
Okay, Scott, Ben W. writes to us from, I'm going to mispronounce this, Sammamish, Washington.
That's got to be close.
I don't know. It sounds like a drunk person trying to say sandwich. I'm probably saying it wrong, Ben, but thanks for writing to us. He does say it's east of Seattle. So Ben W. says, Hi, Scott and Ben. Thank you from yet another Benjamin. You guys do a great show. You've got me a lot more interested in cars. Well, thanks, man.
Very good.
Ben goes on to say, I'm just finishing up listening to your latest show about putting 1-horsepower motors into cars and thought you might enjoy this fun fact. the Seattle Space Needle's rotating ring operates on just a 1.5 horsepower motor.
That's incredible.
Which was an upgrade from its original 1.1 horsepower motor.
No kidding.
Yeah, he said, granted, it doesn't move the entire saucer section, just the ring inside the restaurant. However, this ring and the related equipment weigh around 125 tons. But apparently, it's so well balanced that it only takes this tiny motor to keep it moving.
That's pretty incredible. It's amazing that it's such a small engine would be able to operate something like that.
Right, yeah, and this is a reference, in case anybody missed it, this is a reference to our earlier episode where we talked about whether you could have a one-horsepower car.
Hmm. That's really, really interesting. Now, I'm going to take a second look at every, you know, rotating restaurants at the tops of buildings that I see now.
Oh, yeah, there's one in Atlanta, right?
I always assume that those have just massive engines that are spinning those things, or giant electric motors, really, that are spinning them.
Yeah.
I never really thought it would be a one-horsepower motor. That may be electric. I'm not sure. I'm sure it's electric. I don't think they're going to continually feed gasoline into that.
Was it the Sundial in Atlanta? Is that the name of
it? That may be it.
Yeah. So maybe we should go investigate. We need badges that say, like, car stuff.
Official.
Yeah, you know, that look like we're FBI or something. Well, Ben, thank you for writing to us with that fascinating fact here. Ben, you also included some Space Needle facts and some opportunities to get more information. So I am going to figure out what kind of engine is running there, or what kind of motor, rather, is running there in the Westin. And we are going to head out. We hope that you stay tuned. We hope you enjoyed this episode. And if you didn't, then continue on to episode 2, because it is going to get weird.
It's going to pay off.
Yeah. All right. In the meantime, check us out on Facebook and Twitter. Visit our website, carstuffshow.com, and send us an email with your own weird car stories or just engine facts. Our address is
carstuff@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com.